Hi, I'm Emil Heskey, and join me on the hero's journey.
Okay, guys, so welcome to the hero's journey with Emil Heskey and myself, Warren Williams. So we have kind of, me and Emil, been working together for many years now, and we kind of decided, just looking at the way the world is today, and just, and Emil will jump in a little bit and explain part of his reasoning behind this. But, you know, we sat down and we thought about what needed to happen with regards to some of the challenges that are going on with sport and some of the athletes in sport that are struggling with after, you know, kind of finishing their careers, kind of being lost, not having a sense of direction. And some of the challenges that come through that now, some of the challenges that go on in sport are mirrored in life. So me and Emil kind of thought about putting together a podcast where part of it will be us having quite deep conversations on mental health, because now this is becoming more of a buzzword. People are starting to accept the responsibility of talking openly about their emotional problems, their traumas. And even sports people, you know, people that are making a lot of money still have the burden. So we kind of want to start talking about and addressing the concerns that a lot of elite athletes go through. You know, Emil's obviously, when he starts talking, he'll explain his vast experience and how he's had conversations with a lot of elite athletes that have a lot of these challenges that we, you know, normal humans think that they don't have. They're not above it. And so part of this podcast will be for us to have deep conversations about mental health. We will also be interviewing or talking with, having open discussions with some of Emil's friends who are, you know, elite level athletes that have been in the Premiership, as well as other sports. And Emil will talk about that himself. You know, we'll talk about those sort of things. And part of this is kind of to bring to the awareness of the public the struggles that everyone goes through. We're hoping that you guys can kind of walk along with us in the journey as we learn how to open ourselves up to you guys and get good information and feedback from you guys also. So that's part of what the hero's journey is. So today's episode, we are going to talk about the hero's journey itself, because the hero's journey represents 12 steps that we have to go through as part of a life process. Once we kind of finish that, I'm going to then share the floor with Emil for him to just kind of explain part of his open challenges that he's had through his journey. So before we start that, I will start by just quickly introducing myself for those of you who don't know me. So my name is Warren Williams, and I have a business called warrenwilliamscoaching.com. My main emphasis is to focus on transformation, so I call myself an alchemist. My goal is to focus on improving people's wellness, whether that's exercise, nutrition, diet, lifestyle, and movement. So that I kind of have been doing this for about 20 years. I work with athletes as well as normal people that work in jobs, 9-to-5, corporates, and so on. So now, Emil, the man of the moment, if you could just kind of introduce yourself and kind of, you know, just share a summary of, you know, where you were.
Hi, I'm Emil Heskey, former footballer, started playing at a very young age in Leicester, started with Leicester, then went on to Liverpool, Birmingham, Wigan, Aston Villa, Jets, and then finally Bolton. Retired, and now do a few little things with Leicester because of my background, coming from Leicester, starting there, coming through their academy, being a success story for them. Do a little bit of ambassadorial work for them, and look after my kids as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, and you have quite a big family, don't you?
Yeah, I have a fairly big family. I have 7 kids in total. 3 with my ex and 4 with my wife. So 4 of us, 4 living with me.
And I think that's really important to kind of share, because, you know, a lot of times before we get into this whole breakdown of the hero's journey, I think sometimes when people see people that have been quote unquote successful, people think that, well, they've got nannies, they've got, you know, people that just look after their children, and that's why they can just get on with and do what they do. But the fact that you have such a big extended family, it means that you're also challenged with the normal things that most people think are beyond you. So I'm so glad that you kind of shared that. And, you know, as I said, when we kind of get into this stuff and share your story, people will hopefully be able to see themselves in your story and realize the challenges that you go through is the same challenges that they have to go through, and how you've done so well to kind of overcome them to create a kind of successful life.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about challenges, as a parent, your challenges never stop just because you got money or just because you play football or play cricket or do another job, your challenges never stop. Whoever tells you that your challenges stop, then they're lying to you.
Yeah.
I obviously had three kids before I was 24.
Right, wow, yeah.
So by the time I was 24, and within football, you don't really have that much time to do anything. You're in the hotel, you're doing this, you're doing that. So I never really got much time with my children then. And now I'm having to do, I'm doing a lot more with my younger kids. They play a lot of sports.
Yeah, yeah. We'll definitely get into that. I'm glad you shared it. We'll get into that in a little bit. So what we'll start with now is we'll just start by breaking down the hero's journey, what it really is. And then once we get through that, we'll relate this back to Emil. And like I said, the whole point of this is, first of all, for the listeners to actually understand the hero's journey and how the hero's journey relates to the challenges that we all go through in life. I'm going to use some film references so you can actually see certain films that actually break down the hero's journey. And then after that, we're going to just talk to Emil again and kind of get Emil to walk through his hero's journey and see the challenges that he's had to face and the things he's had to overcome. Because ultimately, most people in the Western world struggle with stress that are related to two different things. Fear about the past, which is depression, and fear about the future, which is anxiety. So always remember that, people, we have two polarities that we're pulled through when it comes to our daily stress. Fear about the past, which is depression, fear about the future, which is anxiety. And how do we deal with that? Because we all have challenges every single day of our lives. And like Emil just said, money doesn't make you above it. So Emil's a really good example because he's in the limelight. So you'll see how somebody can actually go through these challenges and you can see your own journey in Emil's journey. So, okay, let's start with 12 stages. So the hero's journey, first of all, starts with something called the ordinary world. So this is 12 steps. The ordinary world, and Emil, I want you to kind of listen to this as well so you can see where you are in this story. Mm-hmm. So you've got the ordinary world, which is most humans start within this ordinary world. So that basically means when you are born, everything to you is just normal. Like whether you see a lot of money or a little bit of money or cars or houses, it's all classes ordinary. It's the ordinary world to you. You see everything in your life as tranquil or trivial. You don't understand stress. You don't understand mortgages. You don't understand debt. It's just all ordinary. It's the ordinary world. You don't see anything as fantasy or anything great. You just see everything as normal. This is where most of us are until we grow up and start to realize that our parents have to work to make money and so on. So we see everything as just normal, ordinary world. We think everybody has the same problems or challenges as we. We don't understand the difference because, you know, children are egocentric, which basically means they think that everything around their environment is an extension of them. So if their parents are happy, they are happy. If their parents are sad, they are sad. And for you guys listening, have you ever seen a child start laughing because the parents start laughing? The child doesn't know why they're laughing, but they just start laughing because they think it's obviously because of them. So this is the ordinary world where you just think everything is normal. The second stage is called the call to adventure. So this is typically when somebody gets to an adolescent stage of life, so maybe in their early teens, and something stimulates them. They may watch the TV and see Florence Griffish Joyner, who was a famous sprinter, female sprinter back in the day. They may see her run a race and be inspired and think, wow, I want to become a racer. I want to become, or they may watch Lewis Hamilton or Ryan Giggs and think, oh my gosh, I want to be like that. So that's the call to adventure. They see something that stimulates them to want to become. They find a path that they'd love to do. You may watch Bruce Lee or Muhammad Ali. And then the third stage is refusal of the call. So what that basically means is you initially have a call to action where you want to do something. And then for some reason you think, you know what? Nah, I think that's going to be too hard. That's too challenging. I don't have the money. I don't have the support. I don't have the time. Oh, I can't. I only live in Brighton. There's no way I could ever do that. And so on. So you refuse the call. That's called refusal of the call. And then eventually the next stage, for the fourth stage, is meeting the mentor. So meeting the mentor normally means you kind of refuse the call, and then someone somewhere kind of inspires you once again. You may meet someone. So let's use football for an example. You may meet someone who is a professional footballer or an aspiring footballer, and they become your mentor. They inspire you personally. And you're inspired by that person, by their work ethic, by their lifestyle, their drive, or so whatever it is, their intuition, their wisdom, their knowledge. And so they become your mentor and they inspire you to want to do the thing that you first of all felt you were pulled to do. So that's meeting the mentor. And then the fifth stage, this is where action happens. Fifth stage is called crossing the threshold. So this is where you either become the teacher, or you become the footballer, you become the athlete, you become the CEO, or whatever it is, you actually start to live that. You cross the threshold, you've trained yourself up to the point where you are now living that dream, for lack of a better word. So for Emil, that would be like, you become that footballer, you get your football contract, as an example. Mm-hmm. And then once you cross the threshold, the challenges increase. Because now there's the demands of the public and pressure from your peers. And this is called tests, allies, and enemies. So for Emil, that would be such as, you know, you become financially, you get more money, you get more pressure, the clubs are looking at you. So that's the tests. You're tested, how good are you? Can you score? Can you set up? Your allies, do you have people around you that can support you? Or do you have enemies that want to try and take something away from you? So that's the tests, allies, and enemies. Once you go past that stage, the next stage, which is stage 7, is the innermost cave. So what happens is normally we go through these challenges and these tests, and it forces us to kind of look within ourselves. Do we have the resolve? Do we have the strength of character to continue with the pressure of whatever this test has put us under? So that's called the innermost cave. And if you see those martial art films where sometimes the martial artist learns from the master, and then he has to go inside the mountains and meditate for 10 years and then come back out, that's why they call it the innermost cave. You go inside this cave, which is kind of like going inside yourself, self-reflecting. And then once you kind of come out of that cave, you have greater wisdom or knowledge or insight or experience. So then you move to the next stage, which is the ordeal. And the ordeal stage is the baptism of fire. And I know everybody listening knows what that means, that baptism of fire, where you go through some great challenge. And if you're able to get through that baptism of fire, where you face your fears, then you get to the reward stage. And the reward stage is where you start to just, everything starts to flow for you. You know, you get through these hardships, and now you're kind of just running with the, you know, you're running with it. You got your good football contract. You get this, you know, the love from the fans or whatever it may be. You get to that reward stage and then you're financially compensated for your skill set. Because ultimately, if you're good enough, you get, you know, what you receive is based on the skills that you have, whether it's a coach or a footballer or a masseuse or, you know, a therapist of some type. Your skill set is rewarded based on how good you are. So that's the reward stage. Then after that, you go to the road back. The road back is where your life starts to become what you wanted it to become. You're now on the way back to your dream, which is what you wanted at the start of your life. And then you get to the next stage, which is resurrection, which is basically where you are now totally authentic. Like, think of someone like Oprah Winfrey. You know, she's now at a point where she doesn't have to do anything else. Everything is just unfolding. She's as good as she can be, as successful as she can be, as known. It's like, you're not going to be any more known than Oprah Winfrey. So she's at that stage where she's totally in line with everything that she wants to do. So you're in that resurrection stage. And then the last stage is return with elixir. So that basically means you're just living your truth. What we call the Midas touch. You know, whatever you touch turns to gold. Everything is flow. Every decision you make is right. Every time you think of something, it happens. Everything in your life is just totally in flow. So those are the 12 steps of the hero's journey. And just before I bring Emil back in to just kind of share where he feels he's gone through the hero's journey, and we'll summarize each point as we talk to Emil. An example is, a great example for a film is The Matrix. Because what you see in The Matrix is Neo, at the start of the film, he's a computer operator. I don't know if you remember that, Emil, right at the start of The Matrix. He works at a bank, or I can't remember, some business, and he's just a computer operator. And then he gets this phone call from Trinity, and then he's like, who's this weird person? And then he meets her in a bar. That's the call to action. And then he gets a phone call from Morpheus. I don't know if you remember that. He gets a phone call from Morpheus. And then Morpheus is like, you've been looking for me, and we're going to have a meeting. And then, you know, they sat down, and then they have the blue pill and the red pill.
Yeah.
That's when he meets the mentor. He sits down with Morpheus, and he meets the mentor. Then he takes the blue pill. Then he goes into the Matrix. That's when he crosses the threshold. And then when he crosses the threshold, he's in the Matrix now. And then, I don't know if you remember, Emil, when he has to do the fight training, and then he fights Morpheus, and he gets beaten up. That's when he has the tests and the allies.
Okay.
And then eventually, he fights the machine, Smith. He gets beaten up by Smith. That's the innermost cave, and he has to kind of go inside himself. And then eventually, he beats Smith. He goes through the reward. And then at the end of the film, when they fire the bullets at him, and he just stops them with his hand, yeah. And then all the bullets drop to the floor, and then he destroys them. That's the resurrection. He becomes the truth. So at the start of the film, he gets the call to action, gets the phone call. He meets the mentor, Morpheus. He takes the blue pill. He crosses the threshold. He has the innermost cave. He learns that he has to get beaten up to become better. He goes through the ordeals. He goes through the baptism of fire. He eventually beats Smith, and he returns. He becomes what he was born to be. Mm-hmm. So that's, that film's a really good example of the hero's journey. So now we've kind of gone through that. Let's go back to the start, the ordinary world. So going back to the start of your journey, Emil, when you kind of were growing up, what was ordinary about your life, when you were growing up?
In what sense?
Like, when you were growing up and you kind of were just, going through life before you kind of got into football, what was your life like before you kind of did you feel that you had a purpose, or were you just getting by?
Never thought about that, to be honest with you. As a kid growing up, I'm from Leicester.
Mm.
So just normal. We were living in Highfields, which is generally a black neighbourhood.
Right.
And just trundling along, enjoying life. Had a great family experience with my parents. And we eventually moved out of there and went to a more, what you'd possibly call a more affluent neighbourhood. And if I'm honest with you, sports, in a sense of football, never came into my life until I'd moved from the Highfields into Evington. So we'd moved because we never really played. All I did was running and messing about with your mates and stuff like that. So football never really, and sports never really came into it.
So just as we pause there for a second, that's a good example. So I'm glad you shared it, because there's nothing that really stood out. And the way you're explaining it is like, well, it's just normal. That's a key example of the ordinary world. You just do what everybody else does. You play knockdown ginger, you play tag or whatever. You hang out.
Kirby, where you throw the ball against the curb at each other.
No, I've not heard of that one, actually. No.
So basically, where you're standing one side of the road, he's standing the other side, and you throw, trying to hit the curb, and if it comes back to you, you get a point.
Wow, okay, I've not heard of that one. But that's just life, isn't it? There's nothing that stands out. So that's a great example, and hopefully people listening can kind of relate to that, because when you're at that ordinary world stage, nothing really stands out. It's just you're just getting by, you're just doing whatever you need to do. So then where for you was the call to adventure, where you kind of had that spark? You saw, what was it that you saw? Who was it you spoke to, whatever, that kind of gave you that call to action to make you want to think about football?
Well, we moved and went to a more affluent, like I said, we went to a more affluent area. And when I went to that school, which was Linden Primary School, I went from an inner city school where you've got just a concrete playground to going to another school where you had playground plus a load of fields. We had a running track, we had football pitches, we had a pit to do long jump. We had all sorts, you know, a swimming pool.
And that's
when sports really came into it for me, to be honest with you. And I was good. I actually, before that, just loved running. So I'd loved sprinting because you had the you had your Ben Johnsons, your Cole Lewis's, your Linford Christie's, people like that, even Ed Moses at longer distance. You had people like that who you really aspired to be. When I was given a football and realised how exciting that was, everything just went from athletics to football.
Right. And what age was that?
I would say probably about 9.
Okay, wow. So your call to the adventure was at 9 years old then?
Very young.
So then was there a stage where you were playing football and it was just for fun, or did you feel at that time that, you know what, this is what I want to do?
No, it was all fun.
Okay, cool.
Never, everything was for fun for me.
Right.
Because I was good at it and I enjoyed being better than everyone else at it.
Right. So you were naturally quite good at it.
Yeah.
So where did you get to the point where you feel on this model of the hero's journey that you kind of met a mentor? What age were you and who was that? Where you could think of somebody, even if it wasn't someone you didn't physically know, it could be someone you knew, it could be someone who was slightly older than you, or it could just be someone who inspired you. Where was it that you feel you kind of met some form of mentor?
Possibly when watching, because back then football wasn't on television like it is now. So you'd watch maybe the FA Cup, or I was lucky enough because at 9, 10, 11, 12-ish, I was spotted playing for my school team, and they invited me down, Leicester City invited me down to join their academy, what was called just a centre of excellence back then.
Right.
You'd go twice a week if I could make it there, and you'd train with a load of other kids. And then every now and again, you'd get tickets to go and watch the games.
Right.
So it wasn't until then, and seeing players like Ian Wright, that's when I aspired to be. I could say, I could be that, I could be a footballer, and that's when I aspired to be a footballer.
So that was about 12, you say?
I would say, yeah, I would say between 10 and 12.
Right. And was there anyone that you can think of that took you under their wing?
I don't think anyone took me under their wing. The only person was a bloke called Len Mulby, who is passed away now. He was a scout for Leicester City, and he was the one that took me down to Leicester, and he would help me out getting there at times. And he was the only one that really stood out in a sense that knew that I had a lot of ability.
Attitude, yeah.
Yeah, and I could actually make it all the way.
Right. So he's the closest person you can kind of think of at that age that was kind of like helping you in some like a funnel, like a mentor in some sort of way.
Yeah, but it wasn't in a mentor in the sense that they would talk to you. It was just a mentor in the sense that he knew what I was capable of doing,
right.
And was just pushing me, making sure I was getting there and training on time. And he was the one that would get you tickets for the games and stuff like that.
And where do you feel now that you kind of went through that crossing the threshold where you went from a potential to an actual real, you know, lifestyle, like knowing that, you know what, this is the path and this is my path to, because obviously a lot of us, it's passion initially that pulls us into it, and then knowing that, you know what, this passion can actually be something that I can actually have as a career. What age do you think that kind of happened for you, where you crossed that threshold and realized that, yep, you've crossed over into it's actually a career?
Probably about 15, where you realize that you could possibly make a career out of it. Because at 16, you sign contracts to actually join Leicester City's youth setup.
Right.
So that was possibly the time where I thought, well, I've got a chance here. Because at 15, I played my first game for the 18s.
Right. Okay. So what we're talking about right now is kind of the transitional point between meeting the mentor and crossing the threshold. But when crossing the threshold in its entirety is when you actually have kind of got to that point where you're now making it a financial career. So what age do you think that was?
A proper financial career?
Yeah. You like kind of the start of it, the start of the
financial career. The start of it would be 16.
16. Okay.
You leave school. Well, I left school and joined Leicester's youth setup. And but you're on a YTS. Back then we had YTS schemes, didn't we? And I was on a YTS scheme, which was £35 a week.
Okay, and then where, because now that you cross that threshold and you realise, you know, you're 16 now and you realise, you know what, this can be my career. For you, where do you feel the tests, kind of challenges kind of came through for you? Just the initial test, because remember, we then get to the ordeal where you have great challenges, and that'll be more later on when you have far more finance, which creates, and a lot of people don't realise this, a lot of people don't realise that, as Jay-Z famously said, more money, more problems. You know, they don't realise that. That's the true ordeal stage. But for you, the initial walkthrough, like, because I remember you shared some stuff with me, that, you know, initially when you, what was one of the first things that happened in your family when you kind of, when they, everybody started to realise, you know what, a meal can be kind of like the breadwinner here. What kind of happened for you which you could kind of relate to tests?
Well, the first test, obviously, football test, was 15. I played under 50. It was the first test and the first test that I passed. It was 15, went to the under 18s game. We were 1-0 down. I came on before half time, scored two. We went into half time 2-1 up. He obviously, back then you could use all sorts of bad language and profanity. So let's just say that the manager wasn't too pleased that a 15-year-old was coming on and saving the game. And I came off injured actually not long after in the second half, but we won the game. And I think that was my first test. My second test would be playing a first team game in pre-season at 16. I actually got injured in that game, but I did well. So the potential's there and they can see it.
Yeah. So,
I
was just going to say, so at this point, some of the tests can be also pressure to perform, but also physical injuries.
Yes. But the pressure to perform, I was used to.
Right.
From a young age, going up against older kids and knowing that you're quicker than them anyway, so it wasn't a problem for me. But yeah, it's still when you look back, you realise how big a test it is. When you're in that situation, you don't think about it.
Yeah. So then, talk more about, so over those next few initial years, was there anything that kind of came in? Like, did you face, for the first time, a severe injury that may have stopped you for like 6 weeks, 6 months, and how did you deal with that? Or did you find that you started to have tests with friendships, like you didn't know who was being your friend anymore, or even girlfriends? You know, talk about those sort of things that came about.
16 was my first test when it came to injuries. I played my first team game in the pre-season and I tore my cartilage. That was it. I was out for 9 weeks.
How did you deal with that?
That wasn't a problem. It was weird. It wasn't a problem. It's just like, okay, I'm injured. Don't worry. When I come back, I'll be just as good as I was.
Okay, cool. So you dealt with it, but you still had a test.
I thought about that sort of stuff. I was young. It was weird. I took a lot of things in my stride that most people would get a bit down about.
Yeah. So the good thing about this, just because sometimes we have tests, a lot of it relates to our perception of those tests. It doesn't mean they're not tests. It just means that some of us have the ability to be able to deal with, you know, the challenges of whereas other people kind of capitulate. And that's what makes the difference. Because there's a saying in life coaching, we have a saying that if you're not living life on the edge, you're taking up too much space. And a lot of that relates to, some people say they want success, but they're fearful of the challenges to create that success. Whereas some people, like what you're kind of expressing, you revel in the challenge. It almost fuels you, like, to be able to have something to overcome, whereas some people fear the challenges. And that's what these tests are kind of showing, as a test of character. So did you find at that time, was there, and I say, it doesn't have to be 16, it could be, you know, within 3 or 4 years of that period for you, mm-hmm. did you get any enemies or any backlash with family or parents or any of those sort of things?
No, I didn't actually. Everything was fine. I was still living at home. The biggest, well, looking back, when you look back, the biggest one was I bought our family home.
Right.
And looking back, that's a massive burden to put on us. I was 18 at the time. Massive burden to put on an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
I think I'd signed a 3-year contract. That if I broke my leg.
Yeah.
Looking back now, I never thought about them sort of things when I was thinking. Looking back now, if I broke my leg, what would have happened with me having that sort of noose around your neck?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember we spoke off air about that sort of stuff, yeah. And it's definitely, because like you said, if you're now, it's like, you know, for someone else, if you buy a house and you're assuming that because you've got a 3-year contract and you're thinking, well, obviously I can pay this off because I've got a 3-year contract. But then for them, they get leukemia or something and they've got a young family. How the heck do they deal with that? That's a massive test, but you don't think about it prior to the event. You hope that everything will be fine. It's the same as, you know, most people in the Western world that are living, like most people in the Western world are just 1 or 2 paychecks from bankruptcy at all times. Yeah. So, you know, most people live from paycheck to paycheck. So they hope that they'll have enough money next month to pay the rent or the mortgage. Then they hope next month and so on and so on and so on. So most of the time we always go through these tests and challenges. But, you know, the whole point of sharing some of your stuff is for people to realize that, like you said, having more money doesn't make you above problems, because everybody has different tests and different challenges in different ways. So where do you feel that you got to a point in your career where you had to kind of face yourself? Like, what happened? Because it happens to everyone somewhere in your career where you had to kind of look inside yourself. And it doesn't have to be just relating to football. It can just be through your career where you've kind of found that you had to go inside yourself, go into that cave. Like, self-reflect, was it a moment in, let's, like, an example, a moment in your first relationship, you know, with your children? Was it a time with your parents? Or was it where you were at Liverpool and then eventually you got transferred to another club and you had to kind of look into yourself? Was there a time where you were performing brilliantly and then all of a sudden you just didn't perform so well, where you kind of had to kind of look at yourself and say, what the heck's going on? Where was that for you?
You get them all the time, if I'm honest with you. It's not just one time. You get it all the time. Football is a sport that you're always questioning yourself.
Yeah. But what I mean is, because obviously, like you said, you do get those all the time. But what was kind of the first major point that you can remember growing up? So we're still at these earlier stages where you kind of first had to kind of... Because you're correct. Even though you grow, you always, as they say, you have peaks and valleys. You always have those. But just because we're using the model, where do you think your kind of first, your first major time that you can remember where you had to kind of look inside yourself, and what was it that triggered that?
It would possibly be racism is a big thing back when I was coming through, especially within society. We're talking about it now on the television. We like to say that it's got better. It was quite bad and it was normal when we were younger. So that would have been probably the biggest thing, that you have to look inside yourself and figure out how you're going to deal with it.
So just for the listeners that are obviously inspired by you, by yourself as a role model, to give them like a little bit of insight into how you would deal with that. So just like give us like one example of maybe, like you said, you played a match and then someone may have called you a racial name or something. Mm-hmm. Kind of what dialogue goes through your head? How do you kind of get through it?
You have to just deal with it. You have to just take it. Back then, you had to just take it. There's no point in reporting it. And it was just a case of Well, if you did report it and you allowed them to get at you, they've won. Mm. That was the take on it from all angles. Mm. We had an incident when I was playing for the youth team, yeah. Where my strike part, we were getting it. We were playing against Stoke and we were just getting, and everyone could hear it. Their coaches, our coaches, fans, everyone could hear it. And it's from the first whistle went, we were getting it. But what happened was, I think my strike partner committed a foul. And then the guy who was on the floor was giving him a load of stuff, both of us, a load of racial slurs and everything. Mm. Another guy come running over, giving it as well. You black this, you do, blah, blah, blah. They didn't realise that he was an ex-boxer as well. So he floored one with two quick punches. And then the other one got up, who he'd fouled. He put him back down. And, they basically had to take both of them off. And they were told that he has to be substituted. Or he was told to be substituted. Things like that, I have a different temperament to that lad, so I probably wouldn't have done that. I'd have just looked at him, laughed, or just brushed it off. Mm. They picked on the wrong guy to do that. Mm. Ended up asleep. But in saying that, that lad got fined and suspended. Mm.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened to them.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things, obviously for those listening people, they may not know so much about your life journey. They know, obviously they'll know about your accolades in sport and, you know, your achievements and being a part of an elite club of Premiership footballers who've played more than 500 games. I think, is it what, 10 or 12 of you now?
Maybe a little bit more. James Milner's just...
I saw that post on Instagram. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so what they won't know, and because I love the way how every single time when I'm talking about something with you on this, you're kind of not, I don't want to say trivializing because that's the wrong word, but you take it in your stride so much that people don't realize that it's they are challenges, but the way you deal with it, mm-hmm. is in such a way. And you know, one of the things I always say, and I know you know this because I've said this to you multiple times as well, is nobody is reacting to any event in their life. They are only reacting to a self-generating program. Mm-hmm. So you know, it's your psyche and your perception of an event that changes the perspective of it versus the actual event itself. So a lot of these things that you're going through, like the way you're able to deal with racist jibes, is just based on your ability to just, you know, let go of it. Just, and you're so almost in some ways frustratingly, so humble.
You always say that.
Yeah. So humble about your ability to do so many of these great things. So I remember, you know, I've shared to you multiple times that I didn't realize how good you were as a player because I'm not really into football. And it was only some of my friends who know that I was working with you were like, oh my gosh, this guy is so good. And they would share some of your accolades, but you'd always downplay them. So even while we're on this, I know you have had some great challenges, but you kind of dumb it down because it's like, it's all right. But that's why I kind of wanted to talk about a lot of these things and probing you, trying to get some of these things out of you. Because obviously you're an inspiration to a lot of children growing up, especially moving through football and stuff. So, you know, even though Emile's kind of like, it's like these are major things. It's just Emile's ability to deal with them is quite high. Right, so let's jump forward quite a bit and we're kind of going to end the hero's journey here on this last point before, and then the next podcast we'll get more into the reward stages and the different stages of your career as highest points. Where do you think was your golden years in football? What era?
From 1996 to 2000 and 2003.
And what clubs were you with at that time?
Leicester and Liverpool.
Leicester and Liverpool. Where, because you share this with me a lot as well, where did you, in that era of time, were there any ordeals or was it after that? And if it was after that, why? And really what I'm basically mean is, because obviously you have a high point and everybody loves you and then eventually you may have a drop in form and then everybody hates you. That's the ordeal stage. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the high point, why it was such a high point in your life, and then share what the drop down, when you either dropped your form or you lost your confidence or it just got to you, or what, you know, where you had an ordeal stage where you weren't performing as well. So talk about the high point first and then the low point.
I'll be honest, that was all the way that I went in spikes all the way up through that. So in essence, it went up and up and up and up and up until Liverpool. As in, I was winning cups, I was going to cup finals, my family were watching me at cup finals, I was having kids, earning money, blah, blah. And then obviously, where do you go from Liverpool? And the only way, obviously, is down.
Yeah.
But between that is I was playing brilliantly, and then I had a bad game. But I was, how I see it is I'm young, I'm still learning, I'm still trying to get my form, I'm still trying to understand the consistency. But at Leicester, it was just game by game, it was going up and down. So I learned a lot. I learned to deal with that a lot. And as well, in the background, I had my first child at 20.
That could be an ordeal.
Yeah, I had my first child at 20. I was still a kid, having a kid. And my son was in the hospital for about 3 months. Had a disease called Kawasaki disease, which how I know it is your arteries sag at one side and get really tight at the other. So I was basically going to training from the hospital, going back to the hospital, then going home, getting a little bit sleep between me and my girlfriend at the time.
Wow.
So I would go from games to hospital. I was sleeping on chairs and stuff like that. It's weird because I look back now and how do I deal with so much stuff? And then a year later, I was having another child.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I didn't even know that. And I've been here for years. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, my son. They put him on paracetamol to thin his blood and just monitored him. And he grew out of that, to be honest with you.
Wow. So
things like that, you know, you have ups and downs during that. But with football, you're pigeonholed into a certain place with football, and says, "Oh, he's a goal scorer. He's a this. He's a that." And I was never a goal scorer. I scored a few goals, more than my fair share. But if I didn't score every week, it was like, "Well, he's not good enough." Mm-hmm. I didn't mind that in a sense because I'm not playing for you. I'm playing for the club.
Yeah.
But people just ran with it and ran with it and ran with it. And you just got to, I had to brush it off to actually carry on playing.
Yeah. So that, cause that's a good point for us to kind of summarize and finish on. How did you do it? As in, did you just, cause I know you said, you know, you're playing for the club and for obviously for yourself to support your family and stuff. Was it really that? Was it a thing for you? Because I'm really trying to figure out the how you did it. Was it a thing for you where you just focused on the positive stuff and just said, you know what, the negative stuff doesn't fuel me. I'm fueled by my positive, you know?
Yeah, I was subconsciously doing that. That I look back now and I'm saying, yeah, that is probably what I was doing. But I'd never taught myself to do that. I surrounded myself with positive people, and the managers were great at the time as well. Martin O'Neill was fantastic. Brilliant. He'd make you feel that you're the best player in the world.
Right.
Until you cross him.
Yeah.
But at that time, he was brilliant for me. He didn't care what everyone else was saying because he knew what I brought to the team and to the club.
Mm.
So he was the one that was keeping my mind focused and my mind straight.
Mm. And is there anything kind of you want to share just an overview of, you know, like your life and one life lesson you can kind of share with people about, like, kind of like what you just touched on, like just to how to push on, you know, what you've kind of learned from going through your life, the stress of, you know, injuries, family stresses, the burden of being the young 18-year-old who's now supporting your family, the pressure of negativity from people. Kind of what one kind of lesson would you like to share about how you kind of deal with that? What's, you know, one thing you could kind of say?
The only thing I could say is I only believe that in myself. I believe that I was the best player. And I put it in my mind that if I wasn't good enough, I wouldn't have been there.
Yeah.
And if anyone else can talk about being good enough, why are you not there?
Yeah.
You know, I can look at a lot of people and say, yeah, he was probably better than me, but was he more determined? Could he do this? Could he do that?
Mm.
I could.
Mm.
That's why I'm here. So I never really questioned my ability. Don't get me wrong. Throughout the duration of my career, there would have been times that I would have been like, you know, questioning myself. But that's probably for a second or two, and then I knew what I was capable of doing and why I'm there, my purpose.
Yeah, and that's a good point, is, you know, your purpose, you know, finding out your purpose. So I kind of want to leave it there. And, you know, in our next podcast, we're going to shift gears and move into what happened, the golden, focusing so much on the golden years of Emile's career, the highs, the drive that he kind of had to continue going, what he feels are the secrets to his success that allowed him to be committed and driven in this pursuit of excellence. Now, remember, guys, you can relate all of this sort of stuff to everything, because as one of my coaches always teaches me, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. So when in the next episode, when Emile starts to talk about the formulas to success, you can apply these formulas that he uses as how he stayed driven and committed into your own lives as well. So we're hoping that a lot of this stuff that we share of our own life lessons and experiences will be able to give you invaluable insight for yourselves to relate to your lives, as well as to inspire you to realize that when you have specific formulas in place, everything is possible. So yeah, until next time, guys, stay blessed, continue the path of the hero's journey, and share this podcast with people that you know that are really interested in following great legends of sport as inspirational figures such as Emile Heskey. And let's keep it moving, guys. Let's just keep this pushing forward. We're going to be putting out podcasts as often as we can, as often as time will allow. And we'll see you guys soon. Peace from me.
And me.
Until next time, guys. See you soon.
Hi, I'm Emile Heskey. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please share and like so we can share this message to the world.